This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
This is Misrepresent, Behind the Face of Fierce Woman.
This is Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. The time is 2 hours before classes commence on the first day of the autumn term. The National Guard is standing by at every entrance to the high school because the integration question is now facing the citizens of this southern community for the first time. A crowd of several hundred people gathered across the street from the high school for all people who favor segregation, oppose the beginning of integration.
First of all, I'd like to say, sir, it has been the pattern of life from time immemorial. I'm for segregation because it's biblical.
I think they'll get in here, but I don't know how long they'll live after they do get in here.
Several hundred National Guardsmen and state troopers, armed with anti-riot equipment, are standing by on the order of Governor Orville Faubus.
It will not be possible to restore or to maintain order and protect the lives and property of the citizens if forcible integration is carried out tomorrow in the schools of this community.
Can you tell me your name, please? Are you going to go to school here at Central High? You don't care to say anything, is that right? This girl here was the first Negro, apparently, of high school age to show up at Central High School the day that the federal court ordered it integrated. She was followed in front of the school by an angry crowd, many of them shouting epithets at her.
An extreme situation has been created in Little Rock. This morning, the mob again gathered in front of the Central High School of Little Rock for the purpose of again preventing the admission of Negro children to that school. Mob rule cannot be allowed to override the decisions of our courts.
This is Central High School, mourning that the colored students are expected to return back to school, this time under the protection of the 101st Airborne Division.
Thank you for tuning into a special episode of Misrepresent, Behind the Face of Fierce Woman. I'm Charlene Sayo, your host for the next hour, and you just heard a clip from the 2007 film Little Rock Central, 50 Years Later by Craig and Brent Renaud. Shortly after the historic, federally court-ordered desegregation of Little Rock Central High School in Arkansas, 9 African-American students were confronted by the Arkansas National Guard, who prevented them from entering the building on the first day of classes in early September 1957. Racial tensions soon erupted into riots, and President Eisenhower ordered a division of the United States Army to escort the students, now known as the Arkansas Nine, safely into the building on September 25th. I had the opportunity to speak with Minnie Jean Brown Trickey, one of the original Little Rock Nine, who is also a civil rights icon and who continues her anti-racism and anti-oppression activism well into her 70s. Now based in Vancouver, Minnie Jean shares her stories about growing up in the segregated South, her thoughts on Ferguson, on doing the right thing, and why she'll never stop resisting. So, hi, Minnie Jean. Thank you so much for sitting down with me this afternoon.
This is very special for me. I'm happy to have this conversation.
Yes. What was happening in Arkansas? Specifically, what was the political and social atmosphere that influenced integration in Arkansas, or at least the call for integration in Arkansas at the time?
Well, in the grand scheme, it was the 1954 Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, which said that segregation in schools, public schools, was unconstitutional. And the Chief Justice made a statement that it did damage. He said it did damage to black kids, but in my opinion, it did damage to all children. That's kind of one of my beliefs. So I was 14 or 13, didn't pay a lot of attention, but I lived in a small city that had segregated buses, water fountains had white and colored, restrooms were white ladies, colored women, just couldn't try on clothes in stores, and with no real sense of institutional racism. It just felt, and we couldn't go to the swimming pool as black kids. So it just felt, for me, it just felt like standing on the outside of a fence looking in, and that white kids could do everything. We couldn't go to, if we went to a movie theater, we had to go to the balcony, and we couldn't go to the ones downtown. We couldn't do that. Couldn't go to restaurants. So although I had a great life, I just saw this distance, and I didn't like it, but I couldn't imagine doing anything about it. I mean, what black kids did was get on the bus, sit in the front, and get chased off the bus. So these kinds of little playthings, really, I think is kind of what we were doing without seeing any great significance. And then there was the lynching of Emmett Till in Mississippi, and he was exactly the same age. He was 1 month older than me. I was 14, he was 14. And I remember thinking, if he can be killed like that, so can I. And I was furious, and I was in some ways thinking very naively, this kind of separation we have is really stupid. Who thought of this? We really could get to know each other, and this wouldn't be. That's because I didn't get it. And the local branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, after the Brown decision, filed a suit to desegregate the Little Rock School Board, submitted a plan. That's kind of what you do in response to a Supreme Court decision. That happened without really me thinking about it. But I was aware, because of the news, there were only three channels, a lot of rallies, hate rallies, white people. The churches were commenting that integration was wrong and was an abomination against God. And I'm thinking, that's not what I think. The school board built a school far in the west, which was a white school, and far in the east, where nobody lived, for the black. So I went to junior high school at the place where my mother actually went to school. So you can imagine the feeling of safety and comfort, because there were actually teachers there who taught my mother. Everybody kind of knew each other. In the spring of 1957, it came on the intercom, if you live in the Central District and you're interested in going, sign this sheet of paper. And I did, and my best friend, who lived a block from me, and four girls that I knew really well signed that day. And I sort of skipped home and said, Mom, I signed up to go to Central. She swallowed hard and said, we'll see. The school board notified my parents that I had been selected as one of the students. There were 20, more than about 100 kids signed the sheet, but they selected from that 20. And then we went to meetings with the school board, and they said, well, you can't participate in any extracurricular activities, and there may be some catcalls, but you're not to answer back. And I thought, oh, I'm so gorgeous. I've got a smile to die for. I'm talented. This is going to be over in a very short time. They can't help but like me. My friends and I were trying to decide what we're going to wear. We're taking this really seriously.
You had never gone to an integrated school before.
There were none.
There were none. So this was a completely different experience.
Yeah.
Okay. Why were you and your friends so excited about your clothes and your shoes, just like what most kids would be excited for at school? And
right.
You really had no understanding what was going to be coming.
We obviously could hear the rabble-rousing that was going around, and we knew there was opposition. Oh, well, they published our names and addresses in the newspaper. So we got a really good inkling of what was coming because they were throwing rocks through the windows, doing hate calls. But I thought, as a child, was that people who were prejudiced were just ignorant and that they weren't thinking people. So I didn't pay that much attention to that because I thought, well, no intelligent person would do this. Nobody who's thoughtful or any of that. So this has to be some kind of really ignorant kind of people. So, which is kind of how I think we framed racism in conversations, that they were ignorant people. But, so got an inkling, but didn't, kind of said, well, okay, I know that there's going to be some opposition. And so your question, did I know how serious it was going to be? I didn't, because it hadn't been done. So it's new. First day, I'm all excited, my new dress, my new shoes. My mom was going to drive me, and my minister, my church, it's an African Methodist Episcopal church, they call themselves an activist church. He said, I'm going to take her, but I'm going with her. And I think they asked the parents not to come. And when we walked, I have photos. I mean, I don't have to guess. It's one of the most wonderful things to have footage of some of this. And we're walking along, going to school, smiling, laughing. And when we get there, well, we knew the Arkansas National Guard. The governor on Labor Day said he was putting the Arkansas National Guard at the school. But we didn't really know what their purpose was, or we didn't pay attention, or we weren't knowledgeable of the codes. So as we got to the front of the school, we're walking between a mob of people. They say it was 1,000. I have no idea. I just was thinking, these people are crazy. And they're screaming, kill them, just go home to Africa. And the photos I see, we just were really bewildered. But I think the most significant thing was as we tried to enter, the Arkansas National Guard closed ranks and wouldn't let us in. And then if a white kid came, they would open. So I was like, oh, this is a biggie. The answer to that question is I didn't know before, but I knew that morning because people were willing to behave like that.
We've just got a report here on this end that the students are in. Down there. You can see from here some of the action occurring down there.
The president was trying to get the governor to remove, President Eisenhower, to remove the National Guard, and he was kind of refusing. And after almost 3 weeks, he removed the guard, and the Little Rock police were to protect us. Well, I don't think they had any experience with mob violence. So we went into the school, but we were out by 11 because they said the mob was going to storm the school, and they were.
Now, this mob wasn't just your angry neighbors and angry community, but they were members of the Ku Klux Klan?
Oh, they were everything. White Citizens Council, White Mothers League, KKK, whatever you can think of, hate. But a lot of just regular people, you know?
Were there.
Mm.
Wow. And this was just on your first day?
Well, this was the first day we got into school.
Okay.
And we could hear, after we got in the school, we could hear this roar. It was sounded like some kind of sports event. And then they were burning effigies, and it was getting more and more like, wow. What I think, and when I see the images, you know, it told the United States people who they really are.
In the documentary Little Rock Central, 50 years later,
yeah,
it has you standing in front of your school,
yeah,
and you narrate in the film, despite the fact that the state troops are there, that the KKK was there, nothing was going to stop you from going to school. So even though you were confronting all of this and it was clear that you weren't welcome there, why did you feel like you still had to go?
It just watching those people behave that way said, no, you're not chasing me out. I mean, but it's an amazing thing that I'm still working on trying to figure it out. What really was it about, and what happened, how, all those things. I thought that it was just the parents. You know, there's a lot of being naive. I thought it's the parents. If I get to know the kids, it'll be fine. And I don't doubt that that might have happened to some extent.
When you finally entered school on September 25th, did the harassment continue?
Well, the 101st Airborne that were sent by the president to escort us in school, and we were like surrounded, and we each had a personal guard who couldn't go in the classroom, but who walked through the halls, and there were soldiers all, they dispersed the mobs and kind of cleaned it out. They couldn't go in the classroom. So the way that I think I explain it is each of the nine had one teacher who kept order. There were feces and glue and disgusting things in the back seats. Like walking into one class, all the boys put their feet across the aisle, right? So you can't pass. So that's kind of the mild stuff, and not a lot happened. But then they would beat people up in the gym, and for the boys, they would break glass outside the shower stall and whip them with wet towels and trip you, well, just crazy stuff. Somebody dropped acid, not acid, the drug, but battery acid or something. So our clothes often had holes, and throwing garbage and throwing, a lot of tripping and body slamming against the lockers. I mean, you can do that real quick. You can run by, smash. So we had assembly every Thursday. So our legs were perpetually bruised, because when you're in a room with 500 kids or 1,000 kids, nobody knows. Well, you kind of know who's kicking you, but...
Yeah.
And the boys wore, some of the boys, heavy, like tap shoe plates on their shoes. And our heels were always bleeding, because those are the kinds of things you can do without being seen.
Now, in December of that year, you were suspended.
I was suspended because part of the cafeteria wasn't a fun place, but as I was going, you know, you kind of to have your tray, and sometimes you're going to the side because of the narrow aisle, whatever. I'm not sure. But as I'm going through with my food, these chairs kept slamming into me. All the girls are snickering. So easy. Whenever there was something planned, they were always smirking, girls and boys. And as the one thing slammed against me, this is what I remember. It was the tray, the chili, the roll, the milk, and it splattered on two boys. And so, when I went to the girls' vice principal, she asked, did I do it on purpose? And I said, accidentally on purpose. I mean, part of it is resistance, because what had happened is the teachers, the rule was, or the practice was, if a teacher didn't see it, it didn't happen. So really early, we stopped reporting incidents. So it was accidentally on purpose. If something happens to you, it's your fault, you know. So you're primed, or at least I was primed for resistance. So when I said accidentally on purpose, that's probably as close to it as can be. But it turns out that my daughter said, I got suspended before the Christmas concert because I caused a great deal of distress when I said I should be allowed to be in the Christmas concert because I was in the Glee Club class and I knew all the songs. I wouldn't have. No way. I mean, it's at night. They're gonna kill me? No. But you must not allow them to diminish you in so many ways, right? There's this bit of anger there. It's like, I must resist this. And so when I said accidentally on purpose, it was absolutely true, because I don't know if they knocked it out of my hand or if I didn't do it that way. Everybody tells it the way they wish it had happened, but I know what did happen.
When you think back of what happened in 1957, you know, do you still feel that pain or a bitterness and anger?
I feel the pain. I do. I don't feel it all the time. What I say is I'm smart enough. I just turned 73, September 11th, and I say that I'm smart enough to feel my feelings. And maybe I wasn't then. Maybe I wasn't smart enough because we didn't tell our parents because we didn't want them to know. And we didn't tell each other because we kept being told that when something happened, it was our fault. So, and it wasn't a disclosure kind of time, so we really were isolated in our pain in some ways. And so for me, I thought I was mad, then I found out I was really sad. And it was sorrow, not anger. So if I do four speeches back to back, I'm full. And maybe by the last one, it's very close to the surface and somebody can ask me a question and tears will roll down my face. So you just use it. You use it. And I use my experience at Central. I do anti-racism. I do anti-oppression. I talk to as many children as I can. So I'm not just back wallowing in my whatever feelings, I use it. And I say to young people, don't get mad, get even, right? You know, do the right thing. Knock the top off the test. Use all that. Because there is anger.
Can you comment in terms of what you think is your analysis and your thoughts on the current affairs right now in the United States, most specifically what's happening in Ferguson in Missouri? When you see this happening, how do you feel?
I just say, I can't believe that people make the same mistakes over and over and over. And in terms of violence, in terms of gun violence, it's totally part of the culture. It's just embedded in all aspects. Inclusive is one thing that is really inclusive. Everybody's got a gun. And I was inspired by Ferguson because people did come forward. But they came, you know, people come forward all the time. We just, in this kind of news or whatever it's supposed to stand for news, it just shifts and something else happens and then we get distracted.
So what inspired you to continue your activism in Canada?
Hey, if something needs to be done, it doesn't matter where it is. I'm an environmentalist and I'm convicted tree hugger. Got arrested in Temagami, Ontario twice for protecting old growth forests. I did a lot of stuff in the U.S. In my college years, boycotts and all kinds of stuff.
Do you feel like you're slowing down at all?
I don't think so.
And so, does your activism then continue to inspire you?
Oppression is a formula and it works. And it requires people to decide not to learn, not to think. And I call it profound intentional ignorance. And wherever it happens, I'm going to call it.
What do you hope for in the future? Do you feel hopeful despite everything that's going on in our society or around the world? Do you feel hopeful?
Well, obviously, I wouldn't keep being involved in things. But I think that what I say to the teenagers on these trips is you have to think. You can't let somebody else think for you because we have this sort of collective somebody else telling you what we should think, what we should do, how we should be, what we should eat. And that it's invigorating to think. I think it is for me. I mean, wow. To be hashing out things in your mind, what young people say to me is, we don't have a leader. You guys had Dr. King, and I'm saying, no, that's not the kind of leader he was. He was a follower. He went where people asked him to come. And your leadership is yours. You get to lead.
And Jean, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
This was fun. Great questions. Made me think, which is what I say. Gotta keep thinking.
And that brings us to the end of Misrepresent Behind the Face of Fierce Woman. You just heard my conversation with special guest, Little Rock 9 original and civil rights luminary, Minnie Jean Brown Triggy. You can listen to past episodes of Misrepresent at charlenesayo.com and make sure to follow me on Twitter at justcallmeshar. Special shoutouts to Andrew Sayo and Irene Cloma. Intro and outro music by Emily Simone and additional music by Stealing Orchestra and Rafael Dionisio. Thanks again for listening and tune in next week for another fierce episode featuring another fierce woman. This is Misrepresent Behind the Face of Fierce Woman.